Hello, listeners, my old friends. We've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of this week's podcast.
You're listening to the dulcet tones of the Religious Studies Project here. My name's David Robertson, and that was the sound of Christopher Cotter that you were just listening to.
He is presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, as is the entire podcast.
Indeed.
And we're very grateful to them. This week, it's the final one of our Origins series, Ara Narenzian, Narenzian. Is it Narenzian, Narenzian? He's got a double-barreled surname. No, that's just us being terrible at pronouncing surnames.
But, well, we're covering both our bases. I think they're both good pronunciations. We don't know which one he favours.
The interview is the final one in our Origins series. It's on Ara's most recent book, Big Gods.
Big Gods.
I don't think we've got much more to say about that. We're just going to leave Tommy Coleman to explain exactly what that title means. And why it's of relevance to you listeners.
Over to you, Tommy.
Thank you for joining us today on the Religious Studies Project. We're thankful to have Dr. Ara Narenzian join us on the program today. He is a social psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. His areas of research include evolutionary and cognitive approaches to religious thought and behavior, issues of cultural variability and universality in human psychology, and relations between culture and evolution. Thank you for joining us today on the Religious Studies Project, Dr. Narenzian.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
Before we dive into discussing your new book, which is the focus of this podcast, Big Gods, How Religion Transforms Cooperation and Conflict, I wanted to give you a moment to cover some of your more specific research interests and tell us a bit about your laboratory at UBC.
Okay. Here at UBC, we have a very busy lab, and I would say, broadly speaking, we have two major lines of work that we're exploring, although there are lots of other things going on. One is trying to understand how is it that people, and from a cognitive perspective, in terms of how our minds work, how is it that people understand, mentally represent, and interpret religious beliefs and supernatural agents. So, how is it that people come to mentally represent ideas about God or other supernatural agents in relation to actual behaviors that we see in religious communities. The other line of work looks at something that is a bit going beyond that initial question. The question is how once people have religious beliefs and engage in religious practices, how does that affect their behavior? And in particular, we've been interested, for example, in understanding under what conditions religious beliefs promote or encourage cooperative behavior among strangers. And more recently, I've been interested in understanding how do you get from religion to non-religion? How do you get from religion to people distancing themselves from religion? That's a fascinating topic, I think, and we know very little about it. And we're just beginning to explore these questions in the lab.
Certainly, everything you mentioned is pretty well inserted into your new book, Big Gods. So look forward to asking you some questions and expanding upon that. What is your thesis in Big Gods? What is the underlying point that you're trying to get across?
So at a very basic level, the book is about two puzzles of human history and human psychology. One is the puzzle of large-scale cooperation. So that's simply put, that's the fact that over the last 10 to 12,000 years, human societies have scaled up, meaning that they've become larger and larger and more socially more complex over time. If we go way back to our hunter-gatherer origins, we see that the vast majority of evolutionary history, human beings lived in very small, tight-knit communities. There was some variability in size and complexity, but it was nothing of the scale that we see today. And then something happened or started to happen around the time when some people in some communities started to settle down and domesticate plants and animals, and then you have population explosions. And you have something very new, which is cooperation with complete strangers, as opposed to cooperation with family members and cooperation with neighbors and reciprocal partners, friends. So that's one puzzle that I address in the book. And the second puzzle is that one of religion. And this is the question of how is it that world religions expanded? So big gods refers in this case to the gods of or deities of the world religions that are, these are gods that are powerful, interventionist, they know a lot, they care about how people are behaving towards other people in the community, so they care about community norms, and they intervene and punish and reward when people violate these norms. What's interesting about this puzzle is that if you look at cross-culturally, if you look at all around the world and look at what kinds of religious beliefs are there, anthropologically speaking, these kinds of big gods are in the minority. Very few cultures have invented these gods. If you go back to historically and look at small-scale societies, very few of them have these kinds of gods. Even today, you look at foraging and hunting-gathering societies. Again, you don't see this as a common feature. Yet, the overwhelming majority of the world today worships big gods in the way that I'm talking about. So not only the monotheistic faiths, which are a good example of this, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, but also the great polytheistic faiths, right? Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, etc. So simply put, the thesis I'm exploring in this book is whether or not these two puzzles were connected. Is it the case that there was some kind of mutual energization of these two processes? So is it the case that as people imagined these big gods, they cooperated more, and as they cooperated more, they expanded their cooperative sphere? And with this expansion, these ideas expanded with these expanded societies.
In your book, you do an excellent job at the very beginning of just laying out eight very short to the point principles that you try to get across here. And I think you do an excellent job doing that. And I was we'll just start with the first principle here, which is essentially that watch people are nice people. Why are watch people nice people? How do we know that? What kind of research is behind this?
Yeah. So that's my starting point in the book. Which brings us to the question of watchful gods, or the fact that, you know, that's one important mechanism how religion makes people cooperate with each other. So now, in the last few decades, there have been wide-ranging research coming, a lot of it coming out of psychology, but also from economics and other fields, showing that when people feel accountable, when people feel like they're under surveillance by other people, they're more prosocial, they're nicer to each other. So, and we experience this in our daily lives all the time, right? When people are speeding on the highway, when they see the police car approaching in the rearview mirror, they slow down, right? We want our politicians to be accountable because we think that if someone is watching the politicians will be more, you know, less likely to cheat, less likely to do bad things. And there's a lot of experimental work also showing that when for example, we make situations less anonymous, people become more generous to each other, more likely to cooperate with each other. And even imaginary anonymity or imaginary lack of anonymity can make a difference. So when people are exposed to on a computer screen, and then they play an economic game with a stranger, now all of a sudden they become less selfish and more pro-social. When you have people wear dark glasses, sitting in a room and wear dark glasses, they have this illusory experience of anonymity, right? Mm-hmm. When they sit in a dark room, these are some experiments done by psychologists. Again, you get less prosociality, and conversely, if you do the opposite, you get more prosociality. So, in the book, I explore some of this evidence, and then connect it to how some religions, which with watchful gods, can have these kinds of effects on people. So, if people can have these effects on people, then it begins to make sense why watchful deities who can monitor when no one else can monitor, when they can punish when no one else can punish, when they watch 24/7, then you're going to get more pro-social tendencies among people who sincerely believe in these deities.
Certainly an omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, big God is quite literally the ultimate watcher here. So it is that's no surprise. Your second principle states, religion is more in the situation than in the person. What do we mean?
Yeah, and I think that's might be more counterintuitive to many people, because we tend to think of religion as something ingrained in people and pretty static and fixed. You know, we ask people, are you a religious person? The answer is yes or no, or the answer is yes, and I'm religious to this extent, and that's it. But what we find is in our research, and other people, of course, have found similar things, psychologically speaking, of course, that makes no sense. Like any other tendency or value or a set of beliefs, religion fluctuates across situations and across time. People become more or less religious depending on the kinds of circumstances they live in. And what we found, and others have found repeatedly, is that that fluctuation can be very powerful. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, that's what really drives people's behaviors, the behavior of believers, as opposed to some kind of self-reported tendency to report that I'm a religious person. So, for example, when we put people in a religious situation, we reliably get pro-social behavior, right? There are studies, for example, when you do situation priming, as it's called. One study, for example, shows that if Hindus who play a common resource dilemma in a temple are much more likely to trust their group members and give more to the common resource pool than the same Hindus with similar levels of religiosity who play the same game in a restaurant. And interestingly, in that study that was done by Dimitris Zigalatas, mm-hmm. in this particular case, how religious people said they were did not predict how much they cooperated with community members. We often find this paradoxical thing that self-reported religiosity doesn't seem to be as important or as powerful as what situation people find themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, situation, not the person. To that point, could you perhaps discuss the Sunday effect? What is the Sunday effect?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a great example of this this principle that there's this religious situation is more powerful than the religious person. So the Sunday effect refers to this interesting study by Deepak Malhotra. I think he was the first to demonstrate this, where he showed that when you when you ask people to donate to charity, in this case it wasn't a religious charity, it was basically any kind of charity that has no religious connotation, and he had people respond to these charity drives. It was done online, actually, over several weeks. And then he looked at whether or not people, this was done in the United States, and he looked at how religious people said they were. These were all mostly Christians. And he looked at people's responsiveness to these charity drives every day of the week. And what he found was, in any given day, religious people were no more or no less likely to be pro-social, giving more than non-religious people, except for Sundays. For Sundays, Christians become more charitable, nicer, right? And there might be different interpretations to this. Maybe it's about going to church. But one thing that I think is going on is that on Sunday, it's like a natural priming, right? On Sunday, your religious beliefs are on your mind more than on a Saturday or on a Monday. And that should matter. And that should make a difference. And in fact, he found 300% increase in charitability on Sundays.
Wow. You had mentioned religious priming a minute ago, and I don't want to go too far down this trail to step out of line with the principles here, but I noticed there's lots of priming research in your book that you cite from, and perhaps a question I have is what might constitute a religious prime? Because if we know under laboratory conditions that religious prime is something very specific and kind of everything in the world is a prime, you know, from reading the cover to a book towards seeing something. How much are priming studies actually telling us about behavior when we know another prime could supervene upon that one?
Good question. So, and in fact, you are raising an important issue, which is that in lab experiments, we try to isolate a particular cue and then look at the effect of that cue on behavior. But in the real world, of course, there are many people are being exposed to multiple cues at the same time. These cues are intertwined, unless the situation is quite extreme and you're being flooded by one particular set of cues. So we do that in the experiments, in lab experiments, because we're trying to understand cause and effect. That's what the priming experiments can deliver us. On the other hand, of course, at the end of the day, we would like to know how much of this travels to the real world, works in the real world. But I can give you several examples of real-world priming effects. I gave you two already, right? Mm-hmm. If you're Hindu, you're playing a game in a temple, you're going to be more prosocial. There are similar studies with Christians in churches, right? Being in a church is going to make a difference. You're flooded with one particular set of primes, right? If you're thinking about God and God is watching me.
That's a pretty big prime, being in a church.
It's a big prime, right? There is this very nice study I talked about in my book, a study done in Morocco, in Marrakesh, where the researcher in this case looked at how much people gave money to charity again, and the effect he looked at was as a function of whether or not people are hearing a call to prayers. So this was done on the streets of Marrakesh, mm-hmm. right? And when people are hearing the call to prayers, which is a occasional experience in a Muslim country, Muslim society, they give a lot more. In fact, I think he got almost 100% response in when people were hearing the call to prayers. When they didn't hear the call to prayers, the response rate went significantly down. So, of course, so these are some good examples. And I think religions, religious traditions exploit this fact without necessarily anyone being conscious of this, mm-hmm. right?
Rather benignly.
It's not like there's a committee of, you know, clever priests who sit together and say, let's do it this way because it works. It's more like people try different things. Some things work, some things don't work. But by studying religion, that's another interesting thing, I think, for those of us who are interested in human behavior more broadly, psychologists or economists or anthropologists, religion can help us understand a lot about human nature, because religions are natural experiments that have been conducted over thousands of years of what works and what doesn't work. How do you build communities, right? It's mm-hmm. a tough question, and we can study religious movements, see which ones succeed and which ones fail, and that give us some really good clues about what are the things that work in terms of these kinds of questions.
Regarding what things work and what don't, that brings us back to your third principle that says hell is stronger than heaven. Obviously, hell works, I'm going to say, at least a little bit better than heaven.
Yeah, this was actually, I didn't see this one coming. So I didn't assume this was the case until we start seeing more and more data on this, and that changed my mind. So initially I thought that monitoring works either way. Rewards can work, punishment can work, right? So the particular deity of your own religion rewards good deeds defined by this community or punishes bad deeds, right? But now we have, you know, not overwhelming evidence, but quite a bit of evidence that, like I said, in that principle, you know, the stick seems to be more powerful than the carrot. Mm-hmm. The supernatural stick is more powerful than the supernatural carrot. I'll give you a couple of quick examples of why I said that in the book. So in one set of studies with Azim Sharif, we looked at how much people cheated on a task when they were left alone in a room. And what we found was when people reported believing in a punishing God, they cheated less. Mm-hmm. Whereas when people reported believing in a forgiving God, they actually cheated more. So if anything, benevolence seemed to give people some kind of moral license, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Azim Sharif has also some other interesting work showing that in cross-cultural analyses, if you look at national rates of crime, like murder and rape and theft, you find that matching countries on a number of variables like GDP and rule of law, etc., you find that countries that have stronger belief in hell seem to have lower crime rates than countries have have stronger belief in heaven relative to hell. These things are highly related, by the way. So if people believe in hell, they also believe in heaven. But there are often gaps. Some people believe more in heaven and less in hell, or vice versa, which allows us to do these kinds of analyses. There's even evidence that done from coming out of the work of some economists that hell beliefs seem to lead to economic productivity, all else being equal again. So not heaven, interestingly. So it seemed like, you know, belief in hell, or analogously in some traditions, belief in karma, for example, might work that way too, where karma can be connected to, you know, if you do something bad thing happens to you. That, you know, the idea is that that's going to be more powerful intuition than if you do something good will happen to you.
The number four principle you write about is trust people who trust God.
Right. And I don't mean this as a recommendation. I just mean that's what believers think. Mm-hmm.
How does this relationship work? Certainly you draw in some non-belief in atheism research as well.
Right. This principle gives us clues about why is it that believers distrust atheists, right? There's some clues about that prejudice. So the idea here is that as religions build communities that transcend immediate local tight-knit communities, so you have global communities, as people are interacting with complete strangers, you need to know who you can trust and who you cannot trust, right? You don't necessarily have repeated interactions. These people are not your relatives or family members. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of secular solutions, like strong rule of law and strong institutions, the idea here is that for a long period of time, for most people in the world, these kinds of watchful gods were the only game in town. So if I think that this stranger I meet thinks or feels that he or she is under supernatural surveillance, they're under some kind of moral constraint, then I feel like I can trust this person more. And there's a lot of interesting evidence of this. I talk about it in the book, where you find evidence of religious fraternities developed throughout the centuries in different parts of the world, where traders who have to solve this dilemma to be able to function and create trade networks, they had created supernatural communities.
The greatest coconut courier system in the world, correct?
The greatest coconut courier system in the world is in India, where people hand over coconuts to complete strangers and trusting that they're going to hand this over to other strangers. Eventually, these coconuts will reach the Mahatarini temple, where the priests need coconuts to do their rituals. Right, massive, massive undertaking, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a puzzle from a point of view of human psychology or economics. Is why would people give coconuts to complete strangers, you know, trusting that they're going to do the right thing? And so the idea is that people trust it because they think that the other person is going to do the right thing because they're under constraints, which leads us to the question of atheists, right?
Well, I think you also write in the book that essentially it's one of the oldest, most widespread, least likely to be understood prejudice today.
Yeah, it's surprising to me when we were starting to do this work, we were working out the implications of this way of thinking. We thought, well, you know, this is interesting that religion can be one factor that builds trust. Mm-hmm. This kind of religion, where you have monitors who are overseeing the community, then we thought, well, this is interesting because what would happen then if you think the other person, not only they don't think that they're under supernatural monitoring, they don't even think that there's a God who can do monitoring. Then you shouldn't be able to trust this person, mm-hmm. which tells us that the root of this prejudice towards atheism among believers is distrust. It's not fear, it's not disgust, or some other emotion that often it gets implicated in other prejudices. So Will Gervais and Azim Sharif and I were doing some of the initial work on this, and that's what we started to explore this idea, and we found pretty good evidence that that's exactly what how that's the intuition underlying religious prejudice towards atheism. And we have in the book I talk about some evidence on that. Atheism is interesting because, or prejudice towards atheism, because atheists are not that organized. Mm-hmm. I mean, in society, religious societies where this prejudice is most rampant, they're not that numerous. They're not that coherent or cohesive, right? Like Ricky Gervais said, atheism is a belief system like not skiing is a hobby, right? Yeah. Atheists don't rally around their cause, and except for a few, you know.
Certainly there have been some studies in the past year and a half that have shown that there are many atheists who aren't in the groups that are being sampled, secular and atheist groups, that it's probably, and you write about this in your book, that it's probably far more widespread than we realize.
Yeah, and I understand you've been doing some work on this, so you can maybe tell us what you found on this. But in our samples, you know, the majority of people who say, I don't believe, I'm not a believer, I mean, people often sometimes prefer one label or another. Not everyone says I'm an atheist, but the majority of people who have distanced themselves from religion don't seem to care that much about religion. It's not like they're against religion. Yeah. If a small subset minority are against religion, but most of them are just simply indifferent towards religion. So the great question is, why would people then have this kind of... Why would believers not simply ignore atheists instead of having a strong antipathy and distrust towards them?
Your number five principle here is religious actions speak louder than words.
Yeah.
What are religious actions telling other religious people with regards to cooperation?
Right. So once you appreciate the connection between supernatural monitoring and trust, another puzzle arises, right? Which is that, well, this all sounds good. You can build extensive communities based on supernatural trust. But then the puzzle arises as follows. What would stop hypocrites from entering these groups and receiving cooperative benefits, but not reciprocating, not acting like good community members? Moreover, why would we stop people who want to spread a particular brand of their religious beliefs from telling one thing to their followers and doing something else, which often happens, actually, right? So the question of religious hypocrisy arises, which is a constant preoccupation of world religions. So I think that principle that you should walk the walk, not just talk the talk, I think is a cultural solution to this problem of hypocrisy. So if you reduce this problem, you're much better off as a community of cooperators than if you don't. You can probably never completely eradicate the problem. That's why when there's a story about religious hypocrisy, it's in the news because it's so fascinating. There are some interesting historical examples of how religious communities have addressed this problem, and we also see it today. So if people are committed to a course of action that reflect a genuine belief, then observers who watch these people are much more likely to accept these individuals as credible religious agents compared to people who simply say, you know, here's a God and believe in this God, but they don't do anything about it. They don't show commitment. So it can be extreme cases where, you know, self-castration of the, you know, of followers of the Phrygian goddess in the Roman Empire, Sibylle religion, right? It's been well studied by historians. At one point, the Sibylle religion was a close competitor to the Christian, the spread of Christianity in the Roman Empire. And the priests of this religion castrated themselves and sat on columns, and they were very persuasive.
That's costly signaling in a very extreme form.
Yeah. Costly signaling is another, so it's a related idea that also could help us understand how these communities can solve the problem of faking. Although the idea that I'm exploring I'm putting on the table two ideas here that have been explored. One is what Joe Henrich calls credibility-enhancing displays. And then there's the idea of constant signaling. So Rich Sources and Joseph Bulbulia and their colleagues have worked on that idea. So there's an interesting difference in between these two ideas, but they all likely also work together in tandem. So credible displays don't have to be costly to be credible. And credible displays are primarily cultural influence models. So they tell us how certain beliefs are more likely to propagate than others. Basically, it says that beliefs backed up by credible displays are more likely to be contagious. Whereas constant signaling says that costly behaviors can be seen as signals to trust someone or cooperate with someone.
Your sixth principle here is that unworshipped gods are impotent gods.
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, if we don't pay attention, or if we don't do daily devotions or recognize such God in our life, that for practical purposes, God isn't there.
Right. So, and this puts on its head the, I think people usually often have the opposite intuition, that people are devoted to powerful gods. But my point is that it's probably the other way around, right? Gods would not be potent and powerful unless people worship them. Unless me as an observer, as a possible convert, as a child, trying to understand what's going on here, I want to see some credible displays of devotion to truly believe and commit to God as being powerful and relevant to my life. A good example of this is what has happened in Scandinavia over the last 50 years, where we've seen this massive decline of religiosity to the point that many Scandinavian societies now are majority atheists. And one explanation for that, there might be several things going on, of course, but one explanation might be that what has happened is that religious attendance has declined. So even people who said, I'm a believer, I believe in God, but I just don't want to go to church on Sundays. These are Christians, right? They've become basically cultural Christians. They go to church on Easter, maybe Christmas, maybe for baptisms, that's it. If you're a child and you're observing your parent who says, I'm a believer, but they don't really show any credible commitment to these gods, meaning they don't do the, you know, they don't walk the walk, then you're much less likely to get religion from your parents. And there's some work by Jonathan Landman that looks at this and tries to explore this idea in the case of Scandinavia. There are historical examples like Zeus, right? I mean, in terms of the content of what people believe in Zeus's idea of Zeus hasn't changed over time necessarily, but people stopped seeing credible devotion to Zeus. So Zeus becomes a fictional character as opposed to a real god.
Cultural learning, certainly, I would say, enters into that that discussion as to why people don't believe in Zeus anymore.
Right.
Your seventh principle here is big gods for big groups. How come there aren't big gods for small groups?
Yeah, so that goes back to my beginning of the idea that I started, the two puzzles that I started with. So as societies are scaling up, what you see is that with that process, religion and morality start to get connected. They become intertwined. And this is, again, I think, somewhat counterintuitive, especially for those of us who are immersed in the Abrahamic traditions. Right? We assume that religion is about morality, that God cares about morality. What else could it be? But anthropologically, interestingly, you find that religion didn't start that way. The gods, again, of small-scale societies don't seem to be that morally concerned. They seem to be more indifferent. But as societies scale up, you see this association with more and more, you commonly find these big gods who care about what you do, who know what's going on, who monitor, who punish, reward. So following up on the line of reasoning that we've been talking about, the idea here is that as societies develop these moralizing gods, these monitors, these supernatural monitors, then in turn can contribute to cooperation and trust at a larger scale, which then leads the societies to expand even more. And you get this kind of self-reinforcing process, sometimes called autocatalytic process, right? We can debate about which came first. Did large-scale societies came first and then big gods came next, and or vice versa? But in either case, probably they were mutually energizing elements or factors in cultural evolution. So that's the idea of that principle. That another way of putting this is that small-scale groups don't need big gods, right? You need big gods if you want cooperation at a larger scale. If you want to expand the sphere of cooperation, you need some way of getting people to be nice to each other, even though they don't have an incentive to be nice to each other with complete strangers. Modern secular institutions have solved that problem with the other ways. We've developed rule of law, we have developed institutions, monitoring mechanisms that seem to be quite effective, but most of the world doesn't have these institutions and never had historically. So they had religion as a solution.
Certainly something we often take for granted in the West with our abundance of secular institutions, as you point out.
Yeah, and I grew up in Lebanon, so I don't take it for granted because I saw how societies can collapse entirely when there are no strong institutions. I lived in the chaos of the 70s and the 80s of Lebanon. Where here in the West, in North America, in Europe, people are so accustomed to strong rule of law, they don't realize that the vast majority of the world, people don't trust anything that is government or the law. If you fear that someone is going to steal from you, you don't call the police because the police are the most likely to steal from you, right? Here, you don't think twice, you just call the police. So that makes a big difference. And in fact, research shows, backs that up, it shows that religion is strongest in places where rule of law is weak, and gets weaker or becomes replaced by stronger rule of law and institutions.
Your final principle here, number 8 of Big Gods, is religious groups cooperate in order to compete.
Right. And that gets us into the question of levels of selection. It gives us questions about how religions evolved. Is it just about genetic adaptations? Is it about the byproduct? Is it about groups competing with each other? So in the book, I'm exploring the idea and developing the idea that it's not just enough to think of religion as a byproduct of human brains. That I think is a very important part of understanding religion.
It's not just a cognitive aspect.
So my position in the book that I'm working on, I'm developing, is that it's not just a byproduct, although a byproduct is really important, and that's my starting point. That's how I start the book. But once you have these, once people have intuitions that we call religious, and then you have different kinds of cultural elements that can come out of that, and some of these elements propagate better at the expense of others. So we just talked about big gods as an example of that. But big gods are going to be more effective as in terms of enforcing cooperation than small gods, then big gods will spread. And once that happens, the idea here is that communities that have big gods, cultural communities that have big gods, might outcompete societies that don't have big gods or other things, all else being equal. All else being equal is really important because there are many other factors that are important in determining when there's intense intergroup competition, there are many things that are important. Religion is only one of them. But the idea here is that if we accept the argument that most of human history is intense intergroup competition for resources and habitats, which seems to be the case, it seems to be that competition has escalated over time, then you get something like this. Any group that develops ideas, beliefs, practices, institutions that help them outcompete their rivals are going to do better in cultural evolution. And so you could see religions or successful religions in that context as traditions that succeeded at the expense of other traditions.
kind of to wrap things up and bring things more to a close here, since we've touched on the eight principles in your book, I wanted to quote from your book where you quote archaeologist Klaus Schmidt. And I think this line does a good job, at least from my perspective, of summing up your book when he writes, and I would like you to kind of expound and explain upon this for the listeners as we close here. First came the temple, then the city.
Yeah, it's a provocative quote, of course, and it puts it on its head, the conventional wisdom in history and in anthropology, that first came the city and then organized religion fell out of that. You had priesthood classes and big gods, etc. But Klaus Schmidt, who's the archaeologist who excavated this site, Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey, has found this site where you find monumental architecture, evidence of organized rituals, evidence that hunter-gatherers from different parts of that region congregated to do rituals. And he doesn't find so far any evidence of agriculture or any kind of evidence of settled life. So he's speculating. And again, this isn't speculation. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly how the region started. But this is an interesting idea. I think worth exploring. Maybe for whatever interesting reasons, you first had organized something like organized religion or semi-organized religion, which motivated people to settle down to develop cooperative societies, including agriculture. So I think that's an interesting idea to consider, in addition to the conventional idea that it was the other way around.
I've thoroughly enjoyed this series, David. It's been particularly interesting because I kind of, in my own work, in my own interests, I sort of leave the question of origins to one side. It's not that I don't think we can discover the origins of religion or religion-like concepts. I leave that for other people to do. I just accept that this discourse exists and I work with it. And I'm very glad that there are people out there who are trying to, problematize and look into the history, whether it's cognition or archaeology, and try and find out where these concepts might have originally come from, or where something pre the concept might have come from as well. So
no, you've given me a neat lead into what I was going to say next, which is that sort of culture on the edge, critical religion point, that the origins, by talking about the origins of religion and the role of religion in societies before we really had the term, does reinforce this idea that we're talking about a sui generis thing and not, in fact, just a word that people started using at some point in the 18th century.
And I didn't mean to, obviously. Now, if I could go back and rephrase what I was saying, I would try and not fall into.
Don't. This isn't a seminar; it's a radio show, essentially. But I think they're both good points. But we do need to sort of remember that this kind of discourse about in origins and stuff belongs to a slightly different theoretical and methodological basis than you and I do, and the sort of religious studies as it is constituted, or the ideal form of religious studies as we would constitute it, is perhaps more accurate.
Yeah, so when we're talking about origins of religion, it might be, trying to find particular moments when a particular person might have decided that they're going to have a supernatural belief. All of this is in quotation marks, and that's not religion. It's not,
Well, absolutely. I think this kind of conversation can actually be utilized in a more deconstructive kind of manner. In that we, if we can identify the root of certain phenomena that are sometimes and by certain people labeled religion in certain contexts and within other social structures, then we can find ways of talking about the phenomenon as it apparently appears in the modern world without needing to talk about religion. We could talk about, you know, the institutionalization of ritual or of the supernatural within societies in different ways that would allow us to escape repeating this vague construction called religion that we use all the time and are kind of forced into using.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, okay, so that sort of sums up the series and our position to it.
Next week's
interesting one.
We've got an interview from a new interviewer. It's Dusty Hosley. He's at University of California, Santa Barbara.
No, this isn't Dusty's first RSP work, though, is it?
It isn't. He wrote responses to Bron Taylor, and he also wrote a response to Winifred Sullivan. I've kind of got a feeling that he's written another thing, but he's definitely written those mm-hmm. two for us. And I met him in Santa Barbara 2 or 3 years ago. He was kind enough to show me around the university and chat to me there. And now, of course, he is a colleague of Kevin Whiteside's, who is also one of our editors and, nice. And at UCSB as well. So it's great to complete that connection and get you to hear Dusty's sort of physical voice as opposed to hearing his sort of
scholarly voice.
Yeah. Well, they're maybe one and the same.
Yeah, indeed.
Enough about Dusty. He is interviewing Michelle Dillon on Habermas, religion and the post-secular. So that's quite a... It's a hot topic at the moment, the notion of post-secular, but most people that I would maybe sympathise with think it's a bit of a ridiculous notion, this idea of post-secular, that sticking the word post in front of something just, you know, isn't really facing up to actually discussing what the concept means. But that's going to be a very useful interview. First of all, we've never brought up Jürgen Habermas and indeed this contamination of post-secular. Mm-hmm. There's also a response to that coming from Dan Silliman, who wrote an excellent response to Anne Taves.
That's right, yeah.
For us a few months back. So we're looking forward to that as well.
So yeah, it's going to be a good week. I don't know, we don't have any other news, I don't think, at this point. By the time you hear this, I will have been down to the BASR meeting, so...
You might have a bit more.
We might have some news from then next time. Till then, though.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.